planning, three-quarters of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana reported belonging to more than one racial group. On the other hand, members of the Navajo Nation had the highest percentage of people who identified only as Native American. Census officials project the Native American population will grow to 6.8 million people by the year 2030. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
Penn State is expecting a huge turnout for today's public memorial for Joe Paterno, the Hall of Fame football coach who died Sunday of lung cancer at the age of 85. The event caps 3 days of public mourning for Paterno, who was buried yesterday. Though revered by many, Paterno was forced out of Penn State last November in the wake of a child sex abuse scandal involving an assistant coach. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
Did the economic stimulus program amount to a costly failure or save us from a depression? Investigative reporter Michael Graybell scoured records and traveled the country for his new book, Money Well Spent. Hear his assessment of the stimulus program on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Once again, for this hour, we'll go to the archives for a program that we first broadcast in October. So that means that for this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In August of 1981, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, often referred to by its initials, PATCO, called an illegal strike. The president at the time, Ronald Reagan, just a few months into his first term, ordered them back to work. Most refused, and Reagan fired them. Many people consider this to be the beginning of a long period of decline for organized labor in the United States. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking with labor historian Joseph McCartan, and we will talk about a book that he's written that looks at the background here of the PATCO strike and talk about its implications. The book is recently published. The title is Collision Course, in the subtitle, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. The Oxford University Press is the publisher. Our guest, Joseph McCartan, is Associate Professor of History at Georgetown University, and he's joining us this morning by phone. And Professor McCartan, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Just before going into some of the background here and to talk about how and why PATCO was formed and the roots of this strike, just I'd like to have you talk a little bit in general about its significance. And very clearly in the book you write that it was the most significant strike of the late 20th century. And one can also say that that the ripples from this event spread out into the future and that we're still experiencing them. So let's start there. Why was this so important?
That's right, David. I think it was the turning point event, if there was a single event in the late 20th century for organized labor. It was the most widespread strike that the country had seen. That is, air traffic controllers from Guam to Puerto Rico, Alaska to Key West, Florida, and everywhere in between engaged in this walkout. It was against the country's largest employer, of course, the U.S. federal government. It was widely watched and reported on because it took place in every state and territory and affected basically every city that had an airport. Media covered this event like no other strike prior to that. And then when the president entered into the spotlight of the strike, within hours, the strikers walked out at 7 a.m. on August 3rd, 1981. By 11 o'clock that morning, Ronald Reagan strode into the Rose Garden of the White House to lay down his 48-hour ultimatum that you referred to earlier. When the strikers didn't return to work, they were fired. By doing that, Reagan shone an even more intense spotlight on it, and Then when you consider the fact that these were highly skilled workers that believed that they could not be replaced, that was what gave them the confidence to defy a president. They did not believe that when 80% of the air traffic control workforce walked off the job, that the government would be able to run the system without them. The fact that the government was able to break that strike so visibly, I think, dealt a huge psychological blow to the labor movement. It also legitimized strike breaking in the private sector, which had been pretty uncommon, relatively speaking, since the 1930s, but underwent a kind of revival in the post-PATCO years, where private sector employers decided to emulate Reagan and basically replace strikers. So it was a huge event politically and psychologically for the labor movement.
Yeah, certainly you can say, and I'm sure that it's that the explanation is complicated, but one thing that you certainly can say is that in the last, I'm not sure what sort of period you want to talk about, 5 years, 10 years, the number of strikes in this country has declined very significantly.
Hugely. And I think that was partly workers' realization in the post-PATCO years that employers actually in some cases welcomed strikes as opportunities to break unions. Before 1981, over the course of the 1960s and 70s, the Bureau of Labor Statistics registered roughly about 280 major strikes a year, that is, strikes that involved at least 1,000 workers each. By the end of the century, that number was down below 30. And in fact, 2 years ago in 2009, there were only 5 such strikes. So an enormous drop-off in workers exercising the right of collective action, walking off their job. And I think that that is a huge measure of the shift in the balance of power that happened in labor-management relations over the past 30 years, when workers no longer felt that even if employers were intransigent in trying to cut their wages, that they could resist that by walking off their jobs. That indicated how the tables had turned against labor. And I think even more important than the decline in union membership, it tells the tale of what has happened that has led to the growing inequality of the past 30 years, which is so evident today.
Hmm. Let's talk about, or have you talk about, the formation of PATCO. And the Controllers Organization was born out of a tragedy in December of 1960, a terrible plane crash. 2 planes collided in New York. And at the time, it was the worst air disaster ever in the United States. Tell the story.
That's exactly right. On the morning of December 16th, 1960, 2 planes collided over Staten Island, and resulting in the loss of life of over 130 people. One of the planes actually was able to fly another mile or so after the collision and came down in the streets of Brooklyn, killing people on the ground as well. It was a horrific tragedy. And it happened at a time when air traffic controllers were already sort of groaning under the increased workload that they were witnessing in the late 1950s as jet travel was beginning to transform the air traffic patterns of the country. The air traffic control profession had basically been an invention of the post-war era for the most part. So the whole system was still pretty young. And when that tragedy occurred in 1960, it was understaffed. Controllers felt that they needed more help on the radar scopes. They were also working on equipment that some of it was taken out of decommissioned battleships, radar scopes of battleships being used to try to monitor and govern the nation's airspace. Controllers were starting to get a bit restive on the eve of that event, and that event crystallized a sentiment among a group of controllers in the New York area. And I focus in my book on 2 young controllers who'd just been at the FAA for about a year at that time, Mike Rock and Jack Maher. And they decided in the aftermath of that they needed a voice. They needed an organized voice to try to improve the system. They didn't want another tragedy like that to happen. And to upgrade what they saw as this profession that they were entering.
Yeah, so they clearly felt that this was the result of problems that they knew full well were there, that the FAA knew full well were there, controllers being overworked, having to work long hours and overtime and working with outmoded equipment, that they felt as something that the government had really tried to cover up, at least not come to grips with. And here they said, here, now, look what happened here. This is what we have been talking about now for so long. And so they decided the only way to get any action would be to put some pressure on the FAA and the government, and the way to do that was to organize.
That's exactly right, and I would say that it was the post disaster effort to cover up some of the causes of it that most disillusioned controllers. Jack Maher had been a controller who handled one of those planes, not at the moment just before they collided, but as it began to enter New York area airspace. He had to go and watch the post event hearings. And he was stunned by the lack of candor from FAA officials. And that really, in his mind, as he told me, it was the emperor has no clothes moment for him. He felt like the people in charge of his agency were more intent on preserving appearances than dealing with some of the fundamental realities. And so it was at that moment he decided, we've got to organize.
Just very quickly, let me introduce our guest once again. If you just have tuned in, we're talking with Joseph McCartan. He is Associate Professor of History at Georgetown University. He's a labor historian, and he is the author of a book about the PATCO strike of 1981. The title of the book is Collision Course. It's recently out, published by the Oxford University Press. So if you'd like to read the book, you can look for it in the store. And here, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So the effort to start PATCO, to organize ATCO, this took eight years. And as soon as they started, the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration, that's the oversight agency for aviation, right from the beginning, the FAA said, no, stop, don't do this. We're definitely not in favor of this. What was the FAA reaction?
That's exactly right. The controllers didn't necessarily jump to the idea that they needed a union. Most of them came out of working class backgrounds. They didn't have college education for the most part. A lot of their fathers, and we're talking about an air traffic control workforce at this point that was about 98% male. So it was a very male environment. They came out of blue-collar households where their fathers were often in unions, but they felt like they were entering a kind of professional identity. So they didn't necessarily gravitate to the idea of a union, even when they first started to organize. But it was the FAA's resistance to the idea that controllers ought to have an organized voice of any sort that gradually over time made them more militant and, in fact, encouraged in the idea of the need for a union to flourish among the controllers. One of the things that really aggravated them in the mid-60s was that the FAA summarily instituted a psychological exam that the controllers felt was unfairly administered, that was being used to target troublemakers and to, you know, basically intimidate them. If you didn't pass this exam, you could lose your job. And they felt that the FAA was taking every step imaginable to try to resist them having a say over the terms and conditions under which they worked. And it was that ultimately pushed them more and more toward a union model.
Mm-hmm. I have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so we'll do that. We'll not make them wait. We'll go right to the caller, and this is Philo, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hello.
Hi. I have... The impression I got of the PATCO strike when it happened was that the air traffic controllers were viewed as, unlike other union workers, as highly skilled, high-paid people. And it was easy for Reagan to be hard on them because of that. They were high-paid. They were highly professional people. And it made it possible for him to really come down hard on him. So I appreciate your comment on that.
Well, Philo, I think your memory on that is pretty much accurate. When they walked out in 1981, air traffic controllers averaged a salary of about $31,000 a year. It was above the median of American workers at that time. Now, they felt that they deserved significantly more, and that they also deserved a shorter work week because of the stresses of their job. One of the things that bothered them in the years leading up to 1981 was that as federal workers, they didn't have a cost of living adjustment automatically in their pay. So in those high inflation years of the late 1970s, they actually saw the purchasing power of their salaries declining year by year, and that made them increasingly restive, even as the pressures of the job, as they saw it, were increasing. So although they were doing better than many American workers at the time, they felt aggrieved, and they walked out. But it became very easy for the Reagan administration to point at the controllers and to argue, hey, they're earning more than most American workers, and they want even more. And the controllers actually contributed to Reagan's ability to isolate them in that way by placing on the table in 1981 in their negotiations a demand for a $10,000 across-the-board wage increase for every controller. Now, the PATCO strategists really intended that to be sort of just a statement showing the government how serious they were that they wanted a major breakthrough in 1981 around a host of issues, but they never fully considered how unpopular that would be in 1981, a $10,000 across-the-board wage increase. That was at a time, by the way, when the economy was starting to slide into the what we call the Reagan recession, and where even union workers in the auto industry, steel industry, and elsewhere were bargaining concessionary contracts and giving back things to their employer at that time. So it was really not a difficult task for Reagan to rally public opinion against the controllers, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I guess there is also another important point you should discuss, and another reason why people might have supported, the public might have supported the president over the controllers, and that is that the strike was illegal, that they did not have, under the law, they did not have the ability to strike. In fact, they're under the law, their ability to have any kind of collective action was quite limited. They were not permitted to bargain over wages.
That's right.
So that one could say, and I'm sure people do say when you talk about this, they say, well, the president had the law on his side. What the controllers were doing was illegal.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. What the controllers did was illegal. They knew that. But because of the reason you just mentioned, David, they felt that a strike might be necessary anyway. And that is that they didn't really have the right to bargain with the government over some of the things that they felt were essential for their well-being and the well-being of their profession. They felt like they should earn more. They felt like their work week should be shorter. And they weren't permitted to bargain over those things. So they felt, basically, that the only way that they would be able to bargain over them would be to force the government's hand through a walkout. And in many ways, I think the tragedy of the PATCO event, the seeds for it were sown in the fact that federal workers, including air traffic controllers, lacked the right to bargain over the things that really mattered to them. And so the controllers derived from that the only way forward was to engage in illegal action. Now, I should say for listeners to give some context for this that there were many public sector strikes in the 1970s at the state and local level that were also illegal strikes. But it had become customary in many of those events that the full penalties of engaging in illegal strikes weren't levied against strikers. And once an agreement was reached, amnesty was often given. In fact, the federal workers had seen this in 1970. Tens of thousands of postal workers engaged in a wildcat strike. None of them were fired. And in fact, in 1970, as I point out in the book, air traffic controllers had engaged in a short strike under the guise of a sick out, about 3,000 of them in 1970. And they ended up being able to retain their jobs, even though they had engaged in an illegal work stoppage. So the controllers felt not only that they had to strike to get what they felt was fair for them, but they felt that the patterns in place up to that point favored the idea that in the end the government would come to terms with them and not fire them. As Reagan did.
That's another really interesting point. It brings us kind of back around again to Ronald Reagan and his motivation. And as you point out, that in the two decades before the PATCO strike, there were almost 40 illegal work stoppages by federal workers. And in fact, there was this, as you mentioned, this was during the Nixon administration. The air traffic controllers had a slowdown, and Nixon didn't fire them. He could have. And so one comes back to this question, well, why was it Ronald Reagan? Why did he make the decision to take this fatal step and not try to have some kind of negotiated settlement of this?
It's a great question, and that's right. Let me just say something about the 1970 event so that we can contrast what Reagan did. Mm-hmm. The Nixon people actually decided to fire about 200 strike leaders of that sick-out strike in 1970, and they actually issued firing notices, but then they engaged in a kind of backroom deal with labor unions in which they agreed to rehire those guys in return for labor support of some Nixon initiatives, as I point out in the book. All of that was kind of secret, but it was well known among the air traffic controllers that the Nixon people had struck that deal. Now, what happened between Nixon's willingness to do that in 1970 and 1981? I think two things. One is that the country changed a lot over the course of that intervening decade of the 70s. And the other was that the conservative movement arose as a powerful force in the country over that decade. And in terms of what happened within the country, I think that those years of the 1970s, which saw factories beginning to close, which saw stagflation begin to afflict the economy, which saw the labor movement beginning to lose some of its influence in the private sector, they were years in which support for public sector unions began to wane a bit after a lot of public support for public sector workers in the 1960s. Think of the support for the Memphis sanitation strikers of 1968 that Martin Luther King went to help before he was shot. They were engaged in an illegal strike, too. But the country supported that. Over the course of the 70s, as more and more taxpayers felt like their wages and incomes weren't rising, but their taxes were, their willingness to support public sector workers began to wane. And then you add to that that the conservative movement gained increasing strength over the course of the 70s to the point that by 1981 there was a constituency there that was prepared to say to a Ronald Reagan, you know, we want you to discipline these people hard. And that wasn't quite a set of pressures that Richard Nixon had faced a decade earlier.
It's interesting when you look at Ronald Reagan and his attitudes about organized labor. The fact that he did fire the traffic controllers in many people's minds made him an enemy of unions, and that's really not true. At least he was sympathetic and supportive of unions in the private sector. It's just that with something like this, with the public sector, he had a completely different attitude.
I think that's right, and I think what the PATCO strike ended up doing is overshadowing everything else about Reagan's view of unions, and to this day we think of him only as an opponent of unions, as the PATCO strike seemed to indicate. But what I try to do in the book, and actually this was a kind of a revelation for me as I researched it, was that a more complicated view of Reagan began to emerge. Of course, Reagan, as everybody knows, had been a union leader himself with the Screen Actors Guild after World War II. In fact, he had led that union in its first strike against studios, and he was proud of that. Later on, he attributed his ability to negotiate with Mikhail Gorbachev, for example, to experience that he had as a labor leader at the bargaining table with the studios. So he sort of proudly referred to his union history. Now, as governor of California, he did take some anti-labor stands, as, for example, opposing Cesar Chavez's farm workers movement, but he also liberalized public sector labor relations in California in 1968, signing a bill that allowed local government workers to collectively bargain in the state, the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, it was called. And the Reagan who ran for election in 1980 was also a little bit more complicated, and that one indication of that was that he actually sought a support from some labor unions, including PATCO. Mm-hmm. And the irony, of course, is that the Air Traffic Controllers Union endorsed Ronald Reagan in 1980. They had been fed up with Jimmy Carter's FAA. They thought anybody would be better than this. And they had what they believed were some promises from the Reagan people to help them in their 1981 negotiation. And the Reagan people saw PATCO as symbolic because they wanted to reach out to more conservative, potentially at least, unions to make them part of a Republican coalition. And Reagan was interested in doing that. And that actually led him to do something that most people forget about the 1981 conflict with the controllers. That is, in the negotiation process, he actually did offer them an increase in their wages, far below what they wanted, but more than any previous president had done. In fact, he kind of broke precedent by agreeing to bargain over wages. I don't think Reagan wanted that strike. He wanted to avoid it. He knew it would be risky. He didn't set out to smash PATCO as a way of destroying organized labor. But once the controllers walked out, he drew the line at an illegal strike. He decided not to give an inch, and his decision not to do that had devastating consequences.
Yeah. Here you touch on, I think, something that's also an important point, and something that that the controllers who were fired to this day, they complain that they have this grievance that says, look, he made promises to us. When we decided to back candidate Reagan, he led us to believe that if he were to be elected, that then the government would address our concerns. And so then the question is, well, what sort of promises did the Reagan campaign make, and did they then go back on their promise, or were the controllers, was this a little bit of wishful thinking on the part of the controllers?
Well, I think in retrospect, you'd have to say it was a bit of wishful thinking. Promises were made, but they were vague. And Reagan, on October 20th, 1980, wrote a letter to the PATCO president, whose name was Robert Poli, pledging to work with him if Reagan was elected. Reagan didn't say exactly what he would do for the controllers, but as I point out in the book, and this hadn't been known before, widely at least, is that in the negotiations prior to that letter, PATCO had delivered to the Reagan campaign a pretty specific set of demands of what it wanted. The Reagan people never looked at those demands and said, no, we can't do this, no, we can't do that. Instead, they sort of, with a wink and a nod to PATCO, said, we'll work with you. Now, the PATCO people, I think, read too much into that, clearly in retrospect. But I think, and this is one of the points I make in the book, I think the Reagan people unwittingly helped to create a volatile situation in 1981 in which expectations outstripped what they were prepared to do for the controllers, not realizing how many pent-up grievances there were among the air traffic controllers, in a sense, never making clear that there would be no toleration of any talk of a strike. That wasn't part of Reagan's letter in October 1980. You can't blame the walkout on Reagan, I think. Ultimately, the PATCO leaders made their own decision, but the Reagan people, I think, never had an idea of just how volatile the situation was.
The guest in this hour of Focus is Joseph McCartan. He is Associate Professor of History at Georgetown University. He's a labor historian. He's author of a recently published book about the PATCO strike, the air traffic controller strike of 1981. The title of the book is Collision Course, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome if folks who are listening, you'd like to get involved in the conversation. You can do that very easily by calling us, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and you can also email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to go back in labor history just a little bit more, in the 30s, American workers, most, not all, but most American workers got the right to organize, and one of the exceptions was government workers. Now, in the early 60s, when John Kennedy was president, they did, in fact, get the right, although I think there's maybe some questions about whether, in fact, that really was, you know, it was there on a piece of paper somewhere, whether they actually had the right, whether there was a framework for them to organize. You know, maybe that's another question. But the question is, well, why is it that an exception to the right to organize was carved out for people who work for the government?
Great question. I think there were a couple of issues. One was that the federal government in 1935, the prevailing view of federalism was that the federal government couldn't instruct what state and local governments should do in terms of their relations with their own employees. And in terms of the federal government itself, even the very pro-union otherwise, Franklin D. Roosevelt, then president, of course, didn't believe that unions really belonged in the federal government in any strong sense. And I think that his view and the view of many people in the 1930s was still shaped by one of the more prominent strikes of several years before that, the 1919 strike of policemen in Boston, which became notorious in its time. It was a strike that was actually provoked when policemen organized during World War One in Boston, but the commissioner of police decided to break their organizing effort by firing union activists, prompting other officers to walk off the job. Now, that strike was broken famously by Calvin Coolidge, who said that no worker should have the right to strike against public safety. And, of course, Coolidge later became a hero to Reagan in many ways. Now, the prevailing view then before World War II was that government workers didn't need unions. They shouldn't be organizing. They shouldn't be collectively bargaining. After World War II, that view began to change. And it began to change in part because collective bargaining seemed to work pretty well in the private sector in bringing about agreements between labor and management, promoting growth in the economy. And over the course of the 1950s, people began to consider whether or not it made sense to continue to deny public sector workers rights that private sector workers had. And the notion began to grow that collective bargaining was a democratic right and that government workers should have it. In 1962, John F. Kennedy brought a form of collective bargaining to the federal government in the form of an executive order. But as you pointed out in your comment, that order was very limited in the vision it offered federal workers. They could join unions, they could bargain collectively, but they couldn't bargain over things like their salary or their work weeks. They could not strike. And in fact, the way of getting union recognition in the federal government was such that it was easy for federal agencies like the FAA to frustrate organizing efforts by their employees, as the FAA tried to do. So it was written on paper in the 1960s that federal workers should have a right to bargain, but the vision proved much different than the reality. And that's partly what set the controllers increasingly on edge as the 60s wore on. They felt like Kennedy had promised them a voice, and by 1968 they still didn't have a voice, and that's what led them to establish PATCO.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the first part of the interview that at the time that PATCO was formed, that this was an overwhelmingly male profession. They were all guys, and they were I'm sure that they were overwhelmingly white men as well. There were, however, women controllers and African American controllers, and they actually formed their own organizations. Were there particular issues that they had that were somehow different than the issues that the controllers had as a whole?
They were both the same and different. It was over the course of the 1970s that the controller workforce began to diversify as the federal government began to try to rectify what had been a pattern of pretty much all white employment, all white male employment in air traffic control before 1968. As African Americans came in, as women came in, they experienced some of the same problems as all controllers did in terms of equipment, stresses, their pay, et cetera. But they also experienced things that were particular to them. African Americans often found that entering overwhelmingly white workplaces with white supervisors exposed them to prejudice, and that they often found themselves washing out or being failed to move up as controllers because supervisors were grading them harder. Women found some similar problems and added to that a kind of an atmosphere of sexual harassment in the 1970s. So both African Americans and women found reasons to organize their own groups within the FAA, and blacks formed the Coalition of Black Controllers. Women formed professional women controllers, and I write about them in the book. And from both of those efforts came energy to try to force PATCO to deal more with these issues, because PATCO, even at the time of its walkout in 1981, was still about 90% white male. The diversification hadn't proceeded that far. PATCO was slow to respond to some of these things, and that's another, I think, very important part of this story.
Yeah. Within the Reagan administration, when they were talking about what the response to the strike should be, and when they brought up the idea of threatening to fire the workers, and then knowing that they would have to, that couldn't just be an empty threat, they would have to follow through. I'm sure that there were people who said, "But we have a horrible problem here, because if we fire the air traffic controllers, who's going to take their place? We'll have chaos in the skies over America. Planes will be crashing, or either that, or you know, it could if we had to cut back on the number of flights, it would cripple aviation and would cripple the economy." How did they think about the potential impact of firing large numbers of controllers?
Well, one of the things that influenced their thinking was their belief that when the president laid down his ultimatum, about half the strikers would go back to work. They believed that. Drew Lewis, then head of the Department of Transportation, told me that he was expecting that to happen. I found that in documents from the time as well. They were absolutely stunned that more than 90% of the people who heard that ultimatum decided to continue to defy the president. But once they had crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, and said, "We are firing you if you don't come back," they felt they could not retreat. Mm. And the way that they went about, you know, ensuring that they could still run the system after 1981 was one of the more interesting parts of this story. They brought in military air traffic controllers. They had supervisors retrained so that they could sit at radar scopes and direct traffic. One of the things about the FAA is that virtually its whole supervisory workforce had started out controlling traffic themselves so that they were familiar with it. They were able to step back into those jobs after some retraining. And finally, they had to get a lot of help from the airlines. The airlines had to cooperate in cutting back their schedules dramatically after the strike, and really tolerating a system that ran below its former levels for years after 1981. I don't think the Reagan people at the moment that they laid down the ultimatum believed that it would take them so long to bounce back from this. But even had they known that, I think they felt that there was no way a president could be forced to bargain with an illegal strike, and they were determined not to do it.
Yeah, it just seems that this is a case where the result was, in part at least, the result of misreading, each side misreading the other. I mean, in the sense that the Reagan administration thought, well, you know, so some people maybe will walk, but they weren't thinking that 13,000 people would walk, and the controllers on their side seemed to be thinking, well, he can't do it. I mean, they can't fire us. They need us. And they pushed, you know, and he even did, as you explained, he did indeed make a concession on wages, not what they wanted, but something. And they decided, well, that wasn't enough. They thought, well, if we push some more, we'll get more. And it seemed that it was a case where each side really didn't understand the position of the other and how easily both sides could get locked into this place where they would say there's no way either can step back.
That's exactly right. Both sides seriously misread each other. And in fact, the controllers saw Reagan's concession of bargaining over wages as an indication that if he was already crossing that line, if we show him what it looks like when the system is totally shut down, we can get a little bit more. And on the other side, the Reagan people absolutely had no idea of the level of anger and frustration among the controllers and the degree of solidarity among them. Even controllers who weren't certain if this made sense felt like they weren't going to cross a picket line in which their coworkers were standing there. And neither side really understood the other. And I think that's the real tragedy of this event, is that misunderstanding happened at that level. And to me, what it indicates, and one of the lessons of this tragedy, is what happens when labor management can't really sit down and honestly negotiate with each other. There was a 20-year history of resistance to a real negotiation between labor and management in the FAA and between the FAA and PATCO. And that long history sort of set up this volatile situation in which that kind of misreading could emerge.
We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of focus. Just to introduce the guest one more time, Joseph McCartan is talking with us this morning. He's a labor historian. He's associate professor of history at Georgetown University and is author of the book Collision Course. This is a book that looks back to the PATCO strike of 1981. It's been 30 years since Ronald Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, and you can read about it in his book. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Now I believe there are three different organizations now that represent controllers, and I'm sure that whatever kind of power that they get from being organized is diluted by the fact that rather than having one organization, there are three. How did that come about, and do the three organizations manage to work together? Has someone proposed that in fact maybe it would be better if all the traffic controllers were under one umbrella?
You mean then, or
I mean now?
Today. Well, there's a predominant organization of air traffic controllers today, which is the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. For the most part, it is the spokesperson for air traffic controllers. The irony is that organization was formed just 5 years or so after the PATCO strike, and it was formed by people who helped break the PATCO strike, who, after their own experiences with 5 or 6 years of FAA employment, decided, hey, we need a union. And that was one of the ironies of what came out of the PATCO strike. NATCA today is the predominant representative of air traffic controllers. And actually, I would say that air traffic controllers have done pretty well in the aftermath of the PATCO strike and the organization of NATCA. Today, their salaries are much better than they were back before the PADCO strike. Their working conditions, I think, are better. And I think there's a realization on both sides. We don't want to repeat what happened in 1981. And neither NATCA has made any serious noise about a walkout. And the federal government has tried to negotiate with NATCA over the years. And one indication of what has happened is that back when controllers were organizing in the 60s, they pointed to pilots and they said, we should be getting something sort of like pilots get in terms of salaries and things, because our work is just as important to people's safety. They never thought they'd reach absolute parity, but they looked at pilots as the standard to aspire to. I think that, to a great extent, that has occurred now, and it has occurred in part because of what happened with PADCO, I think. Today, air traffic controllers much more approximate pilots in terms of their compensation levels and their jobs. In fact, you would say that they do better than the pilots who work for commuter airlines and regional airlines. So controllers have achieved a lot, I think, in the years since the PADCO strike. And part of that, I think, is due to what happened. The irony is that the people who helped make it all happen for the controllers today, for the most part, found themselves banned from that work.
No, I think it's, you make an interesting point there that maybe one of the problems that the controllers had back in 1981 when they were trying to fight for better conditions and better wages was that in a sense they were invisible, that part of the system, people never saw them. They were working somewhere in some dim room sitting in front of these little screens, and the flying public didn't know them, didn't have any contact with them, didn't really think about what they were doing. They could see the crew on the craft and the aircraft, you know, they knew those people, but the controllers, I'm sure people just didn't really think about that.
That is absolutely right, David, and I think that it was an underlying dynamic and what happened that led to the 81 conflict. You know, air traffic controllers were very proud people, and they felt that they did a very vital job. They saw themselves as protecting people's very lives, and they did. Yet they were never seen. I mean, when you land and you get off of your plane, there's the pilot standing at the door to greet you, and you can say thank you. Or to the flight crew, you can give your thanks. But the air traffic controllers were really, in an absolute sense, in a thankless position. They never saw the people that they served, for the most part. The people they served never saw them. And that kind of further, I think, exacerbated how they felt they were not fairly treated, especially when they dealt with a management system that they felt was really oppositional and aggressive. And I think it helped to contribute to the dynamic. I look at the controllers, though, as almost like a metaphor for many, many workers in America today. They were in their time, I think, the controllers, even before the strike, they were doing better than most workers. But this invisibility factor was really a powerful feeling for them. And I think about so many workers in this country today who are in a similar position of feeling invisible, underappreciated, certainly underpaid in a far more serious way than the controllers were, but lacking the ability or the feeling that they can do much about that, lacking it in part because of what happened to the controllers and what happened to the strike in America since then and to what has happened to unions. And I think that's one of the things that deepens this tragedy.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point here where we have maybe about a minute or a minute and a half, and again, just to connect it to where we are. So, I mean, certainly within the past year or so, less than a year, we've seen examples of levels of conflict between government and government workers like we haven't seen maybe since the PATCO strike.
Well, I think that's right. I look at Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker and what happened there in the spring. And as listeners may remember, Walker was in part inspired by Reagan, as he himself has said. and trying to roll back collective bargaining in Wisconsin. But the interesting thing to me is the degree to which public sympathy rallied to public workers when Walker tried to do that. In fact, he was successful in doing it, but his popularity has suffered. I think that, you know, we might be reaching another swing of the pendulum 30 years after PATCO, where people are starting to say, wait a minute, workers' rights need to go back in the other direction and be expanded again.
I think it's interesting if that should happen, given the fact that the percentage of the workforce that's unionized is so small, so that we should now, certainly less than in the past, there should be fewer and fewer people who are either members of unions or even have a family member who's in a union.
That's exactly right. What was stunning about Wisconsin was the degree of support for the state workers' efforts to retain collective bargaining, the degree of support that came from people who never had collective bargaining themselves, who you might, and Walker expected, would rally to his side, but who obviously felt, hey, that's not fair. People shouldn't lose their rights because we're in a difficult economic time. And I think that there might well be a shifting of sentiment underway.
There we will leave it. For folks who would like to read more about the strike, the PATCO strike of 1981, the book to look for is Collision Course, the subtitle Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America, published by the Oxford University Press by our guest Joseph McCartan. He is Associate Professor of History at Georgetown University. Professor McCartan, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
And you have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first aired this show in October of last year. Many of the programs are available on the website, and they are ready for you to listen anytime that you're ready. You can go there and see what we have. Also, that way you can check the schedule, find out what's up for the days ahead. That's all at the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
Just before we go, a reminder that we'll be back on our regular schedule tomorrow. We'll be live taking calls in the first part of the show. Our guest will be Ellen Langer. She's professor of psychology at Harvard. She's a scholar who has been called the mother of the psychological concept of mindfulness. We'll talk about what that is, and it's really quite simple. It's also a powerful idea that by paying attention to what we're doing as we go through life, we'll better understand ourselves, others, and in the process, have a better life. Then in the second hour, we will talk about Haiti. That country was still trying to rebuild from a very devastating earthquake that took place in January of 2010. We'll talk about recovery. We'll also talk about current politics in the country. Our guest there will be Laurent Dubois from Duke University. He is the author of a recently published book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. That's our show for tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. And now we will make way for the Afternoon Magazine. Much more coming up as part of that show. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. You will find us online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. March wheat trading at 707, that's up 10. The May contract 715 and a half, up 9 3/4. March wheat Chicago 655 and 3/4, up 14 and a half. May 668 and a quarter, up 12. March corn 639 and a half, up 5. May 644 and 3/4, up 4 1/2. July 648 and a half, up 4 1/2. September 593 and a quarter, up 6 1/4. March soybeans 1225, up 11 1/2. May 1233 and a half, up 10 3/4. July 1242 and 3/4, up 10 1/4. August 1242 and 3/4, up 12 1/2. March meal 323.80, up 270. March soybean oil 51.88, up 49. February live cattle 124.65, down 120. April 128.02 and a half, down 115. January feeder cattle up 40 at 152.92 and a half. March 153.65, down 135. And the February lean hogs contract is down 72 and a half at 85.90. Outside markets, March crude, $100.51. That's up 111. The U.S. dollar, 79.23, down 34. The CRB index, 317.49, up 112. On Wall Street, last we checked, the Dow was up 26 points at 12,783. The NASDAQ off 5 at 28.13, and the S&P 500 down 3 points at 13.23. The forecast for East Central Illinois, rain is likely this afternoon, early this afternoon, then